Support for Science Friday's podcast comes from Squarespace, the award-winning website builder that helps you share your story with the world. Start a free trial at squarespace.com/Friday. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. You know, one of the great tropes of science fiction is that scientists will someday create artificial life, life that must never escape into the wild. Jurassic Park, for example, the dinosaurs must not get off the island. So as things go from bad to worse at the park, a character named Muldoon brings up the lysine contingency, one of the safeguards supposedly built into the system.
What about the lysine contingency? We could put that into effect.
What's that?
That is absolutely out of the question.
The lysine contingency is intended to prevent the spread of the animals in case they ever get off the island. Dr. Wu inserted a gene that creates a single faulty enzyme in protein metabolism. The animals can't manufacture the amino acid lysine. Unless they're completely supplied with lysine by us, they slip into a coma and die.
Well, in science imitating art, that science fiction scenario has actually become science fact, more or less. Because this week, scientists announced that they designed E. coli bacteria that can only survive in the presence of a synthetic amino acid, something that does not exist in nature. Meaning that if these bacteria escape the lab, they should, in theory, eventually die. Dan Mandel is a research fellow in genetics at Harvard Med School in Boston. He's co-author on a study about the work in the journal Nature. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, Ira. Thanks very much. It's great to be here.
You're welcome. Tell us what you've made here. What's special about these E. coli?
Sure. So what we've done is created an organism whose survival depends on a synthetic compound that cannot be found in the natural environment. This compound is a synthetic amino acid, amino acids being the essential building blocks that all proteins are made of in all forms of life. And because our amino acid is synthetic, meaning it must be manufactured in a lab, our organisms can't find it in the wild. So we can control where the organism will grow by adding or removing the synthetic amino acid from the organism's food source. So in comparison to the lysine dependency we were just treated to in that great Jurassic Park clip, while lysine is a natural amino acid that is found almost everywhere in nature, our synthetic amino acid exists only where we put it.
So how do you know that the bacteria can't just evolve their way out of this restriction, acquire the changes necessary to live out there in the wild?
So we test them in three different critical ways. The first is to make sure that they can't escape by mutating. And to test that, we grow up about a trillion different bacteria in the presence of the synthetic amino acid. And then we take it away, and we observed that none of them could survive, meaning that they can't escape the dependency by mutating their genomes, even when they're grown into large numbers of cells.
Mm-hmm. And what great use would you have for bacteria like this?
Well, we could imagine, for example, wanting to produce things like commodity chemicals, medicines. In fact, modified bacteria and other organisms are already being used to produce this. We could also imagine trying to use them to clean up toxic compounds in the environment, for example, from oil spills, where we'd like to deploy our bacteria, have them do a job, and then die, so we don't have to worry about them escaping into places we don't want them to go.
Now, we know that the natural bacteria have phages, viruses that attack them. Are they also resistant to viral attack?
Yeah. So, in fact, to make this strain, we started with a special strain of bacteria that came from our lab in 2013. And it's special because it has a genetic code that's been modified to be different from all other forms of life that have existed for the past 3.5 billion years or so. Mm-hmm. And so the new letters in this genetic alphabet, if you will, allow us to add words to the organism's chemical language, which in this case are new amino acids. And so because the language this organism speaks is slightly different from all other life forms, viral DNA is often mistranslated inside of it. And so we have actually already partial resistance to some viruses, and we're working to modify the code even further to the point that we'll have resistance to all known viruses.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to bring on another guest, because while those safeguards may reassure scientists, will they convince people who are skeptical of genetic engineering that these organisms are truly safe? David Gustin is a professor of politics and global studies at Arizona State University in Tempe. He's also co-director of the Consortium for Science, Policy, and Outcomes there. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you very much.
David, what's your take on this? Should people be reassured by the safeguard?
Well, first, I think this is really an important kind of advance for synthetic biology in the sense that it has extended the ability of scientists to do things around biological containment, to keep organisms in the laboratory and under control that scientists have been working with since the beginning of these kinds of techniques in the 1970s. And I think this kind of innovation really can go a long way in producing confidence, not just among scientists who created this, but their colleagues and policymakers and the public alike. But I don't think that it is the, you know, if you will, the silver bullet for creating vast public confidence around genetic modification and the full agenda of synthetic biology.
Because people are still going to be fearful.
Well, I think there are a couple things that are operating in addition to fear. I mean, first, this technique sort of doubles down on saying that the relationship between human beings and the natural environment should be one of instrumentalization. And I don't think that's a feeling based on fear. It's based on a sort of larger worldview that, you know, people may or may not share. Second, I think that, you know, there are still some questions that are going to need to be answered about this particular technique. Is, if you're envisioning, for example, a release of this organism to clean up oil spills, are you going to have to feed it when it's out there? And then once it's out there and you fed it once it's out there, then the amino acid, the artificial amino acid that it's dependent upon may remain in the environment. If it dies in the environment, it may be leaving some of this amino acid behind. And so in the use of the organism, you may be reducing the ability of it to behave the way you want to. I mean, that's, you know, that's a complete question on my part, and it would be wonderful if there's a kind of answer. Another kind of question that arises from this is if this is a technique that is easily accessible to lots of people, and, you know, in order to be very helpful, it really ought to be. But is that not then going to sort of enable more people to think about working with things that they might not really ought to be working with? So you could limit the ability of a true pathogen to exist outside the laboratory and practice on that disabled pathogen until you really had the process right, and then tweak the pathogen when you had greater expertise and do something nefarious with that pathogen.
Dan, any comment?
Yeah, David raises some really terrific points. To his first point, with regards to how people react or feel when they hear about technologies like this, I wouldn't try to tell people how they should feel when they hear words like artificial, synthetic, or natural. But I would suggest that we be careful how broad a stroke we paint when talking about these issues. There are, of course, plenty of natural organisms and chemicals that can hurt us, and plenty of synthetic ones that can help us or even save our lives, such as the synthetic insulin that millions of diabetics around the world depend on and which is produced in genetically modified microbes. With respect to the point about potentially deploying organisms and would we need to deploy the amino acid as well, it's a terrific point. I think we definitely want to be careful about spreading around the synthetic amino acid, which we're trying to use as sort of a safety key. One possible way of doing this would be to load up the bacteria with the amino acid ahead of time, and they would survive for about a generation or so, let them do their work for about an hour, at which point they would die. And so we would basically need to replenish the bacteria, but they're, of course, extremely cheap because they produce themselves. We could also think about using amino acids that can be degraded or destabilized in various ways. For example, ones that are sensitive to UV light, if we're worried about them persisting in the environment.
Mm-hmm. Of course, a lot of people are more concerned about genetically engineered crops going wild, spreading into people's fields and so on. Dan, could this technique work in commodity crops?
Ultimately, yes, it could. It's a technological challenge to scale this up into plants because the size of their genomes is about 9 times the size of bacteria, and they grow so much more slowly. But we're developing techniques in the lab right now to try to increase the size of synthetic DNA we can create, and trying to increase the changes in E. coli. Mm-hmm. But there is no fundamental reason why it couldn't be done in plants. And potentially one could try to employ a technique like this to prevent plants from growing in places you don't want them to grow.
Dave, Augustine, does that concern you?
Well, I think that if it's deployed in crop plants, for example, then you still raise some of the questions that have occurred with other kinds of genetically modified crop plants that people are concerned about. Whether it's genetically modified or not, they're still also concerned with things like monocultures that might be encouraged by the use of genetically modified crops, and also with the who it is that actually profits from the use of the crop. And so in many instances, for example, the innovation in genetically modified foods, the profits have really accrued to the producers of those crops and not to the farmers, the consumers mm-hmm. of those crops.
Dan, this research was funded by the Department of Energy. What's the link between this and energy?
Well, I think that they're interested in help having microbes produce energy for us. So by consuming things like light and switchgrass and other renewables, can we get microbes to make energy for us to remove our dependence on fossil fuels? One possibility you could have, imagine a reservoir of photosynthetic E. coli somewhere that's helping to produce energy. And again, you wouldn't want to necessarily have these E. coli escape into the environment. And so having a safety switch inside them like this, I think, is making it a little bit less fearful of a thought.
All right. Gentlemen, I've run out of time. Dan Mandel, research fellow in genetics at Harvard Med School, and David Augustine, professor of politics and global studies at Arizona State University in Tempe. Welcome, and thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thanks so much, Ira. It's a pleasure.
We're going to take a break and come back and talk about comets, asteroids, and protoplanets. Stay with us. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. When you think about space exploration, Mars, of course, might be the first place that pops into your head. Think NASA, Elon Musk, the Indian Space Agency. They're all racing to explore the planet. But it's some of the less sexy space places, the comets, the asteroids, and dwarf planets, where the real unexplored territories lie, and they can really capture the imagination. In the fall, European Space Agency's Rosetta mission, remember that mission? It successfully landed a probe on the comet 69P. You know, the probe has gone missing in action, but the orbiting spacecraft is still beaming back information, and there's even news that they may try to lower that orbiting spacecraft to get a better look at finding the lander. My next guest is here to give us an update on what they're learning from that data. Nicholas Thomas is a co-investigator of the OSIRIS instrument on Rosetta and a professor in experimental physics at the University of Bern. Welcome to Science Friday.
It's a pleasure to be here.
You're welcome. You're working on the OSIRIS instrument that's on the spacecraft. How does the OSIRIS work?
OSIRIS is basically a simple imaging camera system. There are two cameras as part of OSIRIS. One is a high-resolution, narrow-angle camera for looking at details on the surface itself. And then, because we get so close to the comet, we also put on a wide-angle camera to give us good views of all the dust and gas emission that's going away from the comet. And so it's basically a dual imaging system working in the visible range mm-hmm. with CCD detectors.
Now, your team has had quite a few months to investigate the comet, look at it from all different directions. Can you describe what you're seeing? Can you describe the surface, for example, of the comet for us?
Well, it actually turns out to be a lot more complicated and exciting than we really imagined. The surface is by no means uniform, and so one of the papers that we published in Science this week tried to catalog and categorize the different types of terrain that we see. So we see sort of smooth terrains that have been the result of what we refer to as airfall, so that's dust particles that have been ejected from the surface by sublimation of ices, but some of those particles don't reach escape velocity, and so they drop back onto the nucleus, and they form one type of terrain. And then we see different types of what we talk about in public as sort of being rock-like terrains, but it can't really be rocky because the density of the comet is so low, so it just looks a little bit that way. And so we have sort of weakly consolidated material and then more strongly consolidated material with great big huge fractures in it. Mm-hmm. And then we can see some depression structures and other smooth areas as well. So it's extremely diverse.
And how much of that is ice, is frozen water?
Well, we don't see very much ice on the surface at all.
Hmm. Is that surprising?
Yeah, a little bit. We've known from the NASA missions like Deep Impact, for example, that there's not a great deal of ice to be seen on the surface. And indeed here, even in the active regions, which at the present time are throwing out dust, we don't really see any clear signature where you can say, okay, there's a great big block of water ice that's subliming. We do see little nodules of brighter, bluer material, which we think has the spectrum of water ice. And we see this in some rather unusual places. We actually see little spots of this blue stuff in the more consolidated material in some places. Mm. And so it's just little nodules of this stuff giving us a hint that the ice of the water ice that's driving the activity.
And the fact that it has this duck shape, does it give you any more insight into how the comet was formed?
Well, as soon as we saw that, there was a big fuss right at the beginning. As soon as we started to get the first resolved images, that this was a contact binary. So two objects that had come together and were just sort of sitting on top of each other. I think we sort of have moved a little bit more to sitting on the fence on that issue. We see in the position between the head and the body of our little duck, that's where most of the activity is taking place, and it's a smooth sort of terrain that we refer to as Happy, after the Egyptian Nile god. Mm. And this area is emitting dust, and so that area is actually eroding away. Now, it is conceivable that region would have filled up this sort of neck region between the head and the body, and that over the millions of years that this thing's been whizzing around in the solar system, that simply eroded away to give us the impression.
I see.
Right?
So it looks like two pieces now, when it's really one piece, is
right.
What you're saying.
And
I'm running out of time. I want to get one more question in for you. The last contact was made with the Philae lander in the fall. There are rumblings that the team is thinking of bringing in the orbiter closer to try to find it, because you don't know where it is, to see if you could find it closer. Is you're going to maneuver it closer in for a better shot?
I think certainly the science teams would love to do that. All of us are interested in getting the highest resolution data that we can, and the mass spectrometers are really keen as well to get as much gas as they can get at. So going close is great. But the difficulty, I think, is that the spacecraft guys, they're a little bit scared. They don't, there's a lot of gas going off. Rosetta has huge, great solar panels to power it, and those solar panels act as a sort of a sail, you know, and so it gets a little bit dangerous. So there's a trade-off to be done there. So
would you like to encourage them to be a bit bolder in their thinking?
As a curious scientist, I always encourage boldness.
Well, yeah, fly that joystick in a little closer. All right, we'll see. Well, so that decision is yet to be made. That might happen then.
I think certainly there's some pressure.
Yeah.
On ESA to do that, and so yes, and it's clear that we need to get to ensure that we get well within 30 kilometers of the surface if we've got a chance to see the lander.
All right, Dr. Thomas, thank you for taking time to be with us today. Good luck on your discoveries.
Great. Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
Thank
Bye-bye.
You. You're welcome. Nicholas Thomas is co-investigator of the Osiris instrument on Rosetta and a professor of experimental physics at the University of Bern. Nicholas Thomas, as I said, he's an investigator. But let me move on. In 2007, NASA launched the Dawn mission to study two of the largest objects in the asteroid belt. Maybe you don't know what they are. They are. Of course, the protoplanet Vesta and the dwarf planet Ceres. My next guest is here to tell us about that mission and help sift through the difference. You know the difference between a comet, an asteroid, a protoplanet, a dwarf planet? There won't be a test. Am I missing anything? Mark Raymond is chief engineer and director of the Dawn mission at the JPL in Pasadena. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you, Ira. I'm delighted to be here.
It's very nice to have you.
Thank you.
We're trying to keep track of all these different objects. Can you give us a quick lesson?
Well, there is quite a diversity of objects, and there isn't even a consistent agreement on what they all are. But the large objects that Dawn is visiting really are the big building blocks of planets. Vesta and Ceres were in the process of growing to become full-size planets almost 4.5 billion years ago when their growth was terminated by the interference from Jupiter's tremendous gravity. And so these are left over from the era of planetary formation.
Would that include Pluto in that sort of category?
Well, their Ceres, the destination that we're just on the verge of reaching right now, is similar to Pluto in that they're both classified as dwarf planets. The main difference, of course, is Pluto is much, much farther away from the sun, and so it presumably formed under different conditions. Mm-hmm. Nevertheless, Ceres, which we're about to go into orbit around very soon, is actually the first dwarf planet discovered. It was discovered 129 years before Pluto.
And so why are we so interested in it?
Well, because we believe that studying these objects can give us greater insight into the conditions and the processes that were occurring when planets formed. And Ceres is actually the largest object between the Sun and Pluto that we have not yet visited with a spacecraft.
Huh. How tricky is it to get there?
It's very challenging. Ceres is, both Vesta and Ceres are farther away than Mars, and we don't just fly by them. We actually send the spacecraft into orbit around them. And so this mission actually would be not only difficult, but truly impossible without our advanced ion propulsion system. It's a technology I actually first heard of in a Star Trek episode.
Yeah, I've heard about that before. That is sort of like a very weak engine, but it goes on for, it just stays lit forever, right?
That's right. It's extremely efficient. It's 10 times the efficiency of conventional propulsion. So this would be like having your car get 300 miles per gallon. But as you observed, the thrust is very, very gentle. And so if you hold a piece of paper in your hand, that paper will push on your hand as hard as the engine pushes on the spacecraft.
No kidding.
But we can sustain this thrust. And so it would take Dawn 4 days to accelerate from 0 to 60 miles per hour. It doesn't exactly evoke the concept of a hot rod, but instead of thrusting for 4 days, we've actually been able to thrust already for more than 5 years. And so we achieve fantastically high velocity.
Wow, the mission has already spent 14 months orbiting Vesta, right?
The second most massive asteroid.
And what did we learn that asteroid?
This is a giant place. It's 350 miles in diameter at the equator, and it has one crater on it that's more than 300 miles in diameter. And at the center of this crater is a mountain that soars to 2.5 times the height of Mount Everest. And what we've learned is that this body, Vesta, is not just a big chunk of rock in space. It really is more like a mini planet. It has a dense iron nickel core surrounded by a mantle, surrounded by a crust, and it exhibits many of the geological and geophysical properties of the terrestrial planets, including the one right underneath our feet.
Hmm. And it was formed probably how?
Say again?
How do you think it was formed?
Well, the way it was formed probably was that the young sun was surrounded by a swirling cloud of gas and dust, and occasionally two particles of dust would hit and stick together, and then another particle would hit and stick to that, and another particle and another particle and another particle until these grow large enough to form rocks.
Right.
And then the rocks grow still larger until their gravity can pull in additional material.
Hmm. Now, I understand that a large number of meteorites break off and come to Earth from Vesta. Is that correct?
It is, and it's an amazing fact. I mean, most of the listeners probably know we have meteorites from Mars, and maybe some people even know we have meteorites from the Moon, but we have far, far more from Vesta than we do from the Moon or Mars, and those are the only three solar system bodies to which we have linked specific meteorites. It really is remarkable.
Hmm. Talking with Mark Raymond on Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International, talking about investigating an asteroid. I'm sorry, you haven't heard that before, I'm sure.
Actually, I haven't. I'm glad to hear it now.
I can't help myself. Let's talk about Ceres. How far away is Dawn from Ceres?
Right now, Dawn is about... the distance between Dawn and Ceres is about 3/4 of the distance between the Earth and the Moon. So it's closing in on it. It's right now at a distance of just over 170,000 miles.
And it must be going quite slowly.
It is. Dawn is actually approaching Ceres at less than 300 miles per hour. And the reason for that is because with the gentle thrust of the ion propulsion system, we have to take an approach trajectory that allows us to approach very slowly so that we can just nudge the spacecraft into orbit with this very gentle thrust.
So it was at Vesta investigating there, and now it's going to Ceres and going to orbit Ceres also?
That's right. So we will get into orbit at the beginning of March, overnight March 5th to 6th, and then the spacecraft will continue investigating Ceres until at least the middle of 2016.
Is this the only spacecraft that's ever done this on two separate?
It is. That's insightful. In more than 57 years of space exploration, actually, this is the first time we've had a spacecraft targeted to orbit two extraterrestrial destinations. And the reason is because of the capability of the ion propulsion system.
So even though the Voyagers have done this great tour of the solar system, they never did this in any of
that's
this.
Right. No wow. other spacecraft has had the capability to stop someplace, maneuver in orbit, and break out, even though, you know, it happens in science fiction all the time.
Yeah.
You go to some planet, do whatever you're going to do, you know, beat somebody up or make out with them, go someplace else and do the same thing. But this is the first time we're doing it for real.
I want to see that show that you're watching. there's the possibility that the Ceres has water on it, correct? Are you going to be able to detect that?
Well, we're certainly going to look for it. There's good reason to believe Ceres may have liquid water, perhaps even subsurface oceans of liquid water. Now, it certainly wouldn't be at the surface, but we may be able to see evidence of the interaction between the surface and subsurface water. So that's one of the intriguing things that we want to look for.
What is the evidence that it has that? I mean, is it that big? What gives you the idea it might have subsurface water on it?
Well, it certainly is very large.
Yeah.
It's 600 miles across at the equator, and in fact, it has 38% of the surface area of the continental United States. But a European Space Agency spacecraft a couple of years ago observed an extremely tenuous veil of water vapor around Ceres. So that water has to be coming from somewhere. And based on other evidence, including rough estimates of the density of Ceres, show that the density is very low, and that could easily be explained by the presence of water.
You know, the more we hear about these craft going to other worlds, the more it does appear that the minor planets, the moons, are infinitely more interesting than the major planets themselves.
Well, I think there's a lot of diversity out there, and all of these can contribute to gaining insight into the nature of our solar system.
If you had a blank check, I got about a minute for this answer, and you could do anything you want with it. What would you spend it on in space exploration?
Well, the solar system is a big place, and I actually can't pick any one mission that would be better than any other. I guess what I'd spend the money on, besides, of course, listening to Science Friday, would be to visiting more of these alien worlds that we have not yet investigated.
Hmm. Oh, well, I don't have the check, so you'll have to go on your own.
But I appreciate the thought.
We do, too. We'd like to hear more about our worlds. Thank you, Dr. Raymond, for taking time to be with us today.
I appreciate your interest.
Mark Raymond is chief engineer and director of the Dawn mission at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in sunny Pasadena, California. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about being bored. Are you cowed by your cell phone? Do you live your life by your iPad? Can you not ever put it down and think for a moment? Become bored? You may want to after you hear what we got to say. So stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. Hey, podcast listeners, take a look around. Chances are, if there's something stunning, you'll stop and stare at it for a while. That's the power of Squarespace, a sponsor of today's podcast. Its platform is easy yet powerful, so you get superior engineering and high functionality when you want it. Everything is mobile responsive, so your website looks elegant in any size window. And because you're a Sci-Fi listener, you can try it for free at squarespace.com/Friday. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. When was the last time you were bored? Or you had a few minutes to just let your mind wander? Well, if you look around, you don't see much idleness these days. Nothing to do. You pull out your smartphone, you flick through Facebook, you reply to a few emails, you crush some candy. Bye-bye boredom. But life wasn't always like this. Remember what life was like before your smartphone came on the scene? You let your mind wander. Something called daydreaming. Yeah, that's what it was, daydreaming. How has that little gadget, that cell phone, changed your life? Well, we went outside our offices in Midtown Manhattan to ask a few passersby that question. And yes, they were all walking with their phones in their hands.
It's made me too accessible to everyone. And I'm always feeling obligated. It's very obligatory. More than addicted.
Oh, man, I don't really know if I could even go day-to-day without it. Email, maps, finding restaurants.
Directions, applications, movie tickets, sports, news. Everything is on your phone. Your life is on your phone. Email, work, everything.
I'll look at it. I'm multitasking. I'm not really present a lot.
I probably kill the battery 5 or 6 times a day at least.
That was Brad Kirby from Memphis, April from Brooklyn, Shalom Rosen from Long Island City, and Shiran from Brooklyn. My next guests are no strangers to the smartphones. They produce a technology podcast, after all. But they're on a campaign to make us think a little more deeply about our relationships with our phones. And they're asking whether a little more boredom in our lives might not be a bad thing. Manusa Marotti is the host and managing editor of WNYC's New Tech City podcast. She joins us here in our New York studios. Welcome back, Manoush.
Hi, Ira. Good to see you.
Good to see you. Alex Goldmark is the senior producer of the New Tech City podcast, and he joins us here in our studios. Welcome back, Alex.
Hi. Good to be here.
Tell us, let me ask you first, what's your relationship with your phones? Can you live without your phones?
It's embarrassing. It's reflexive. I walk out the door, and I'm looking at it, and I can't even remember what I was looking for. Mm-hmm. I'm spending 2 to 3 hours a day on it and checking it between, on a good day, 50 times a day, on a bad day, about 150 times
wow.
a day.
Alex.
I think I have a healthier balance with my phone than Manoush.
Just wait till he has kids.
Oh, yeah. I want to ask our listeners what they how often they can they live without their cell phones. How often do they check it each day and for what? And you can let us know, 844-724-8255. You can also tweet us at SciFry. Let us know, can you live without your cell phone? Manoush, give us a rundown on the Bored and Brilliant Project.
Yeah, so I was thinking about my unhealthy habit with my phone, and then it sort of dawned on me that it had been about 7 years since I had gotten bored, which was pretty much exactly the time that I had gotten my first smartphone. And so I was wondering, is this a bad thing? Is it bad to not be sort of spacing out on the subway, to always be looking at something, to always be stimulated? Was I missing out on something that mattered? And it turns out, yes, I really was. As I talked to neuroscientists and psychologists, they sort of explain that when you get bored, your mind goes into mind wandering, as you said, daydreaming, and you do some of your most original thinking. You come up with your most novel ideas. You do something called autobiographical planning when you decide how you want to make meaning of your life. And if you don't give yourself a chance to be bored, maybe you're not doing that. Unfortunately, there is no research out there to really quantify what the consequences are of us looking at our smartphones, which is why we were like, well, if the research isn't out there yet, let's do it ourselves. Let's gather people to sign up to do a week-long challenge, and that's coming up the first week of February, where every day there's going to be a daily mission, a way to get you sort of rethinking your relationship with your phone and jump-starting your creativity, finding a way to space out and seeing what happens when you do. Mm-hmm. So we're excited about it, and that's over 11,000 people have signed up to do it. Yeah.
Now, I've been using this app called the Moment app, right?
Right.
Which keeps track of all your usage of the phone.
Right. So the other part of the project is that you sign up to use one of two apps. On for iPhone, it's something called Moment, and for Android, it's something called Break Free. And this tells you how many minutes a day you're on your phone and how many times you pick it up. So it's kind of like, okay, what's your number now? And that's why Manoush knew she picks up her phone 50 times a day or 100 times a day. And I was kind of happy. I was like, well, I'm only at about 60 on a bad day. So I'm getting more deliberate about how much I pick it up.
You know, I was using the app, and I was on a long phone call, and the app was ringing me. While I was on the phone, you know, a little banner came up and said, you've been on 40 minutes.
You went over your limit there, huh?
Went over my
limit. You can turn it off so that it doesn't measure phone time. And we actually made sure that listening to podcasting does not count to your total minutes, because we think that it engages the mind in the way that we're looking at it.
Self-serving.
We're a little biased there.
But Ira, I think, you know, what we're asking people right now, we are in the observation and baseline phase, which is we're asking people when they sign up to either use Moment or Break Free and to sort of observe their own behavior, see where they are right now. So for me, okay, I'm seeing my behavior is pretty atrocious. But during the week of challenges, I've decided I'm going to try for, I'm going to say it out loud. I'm going to try for half an hour.
Going on the record here.
And I'm going to try for 20 pickups.
Wait, let me see if I understand this. You can't go a half an hour without looking at your phone.
No, total amount of time for the day. I'm going to try for half an hour, and I'm going to try not to pick it up more than 20 times a day.
And that's the thing that happens once you start tracking yourself on your phone, is you realize you spend a lot more time on there than you think. I set mine to give me an alarm when I was on it for 10 minutes. So you had a 40-minute one, I guess. And sometimes I go and I think, I'll just see what's on Facebook. And then it's popping up and saying, hey, you still want to be on Facebook? It's been 10 minutes and I can't even tell you what I've just been doing.
You know, we need a little conditioning here. What about an app that shocks you if you try to turn on the phone? You're a little shocked, saying, stay away from that phone. You know?
Well, funny that you bring that up, because, of course, there was the study that put people in a room, and would they rather just sit there and do nothing, or would they rather shock themselves?
It was mostly men.
It's the men, yeah.
They can't sit in a room. What's that phrase? The old world's problems can be traced to the inability of men to sit quietly in a room? You know, that was that's
the
where
truth.
That's proving it.
I believe it, yeah. So as part of this, you know, we're having some fun, right? Is one of the last challenges is actually going to get people to do a creative task. We're going to get them bored and have them be creative. And part of that is based on a researcher whom we spoke with, Dr. Sandy Mann. She's at the University of Central Lancashire. And she sort of explained the way that she tried to measure boredom and creativity.
The creativity study. So this was really cool. What we wanted to find out was whether being bored can help us become more creative, because this is thought to be one of the positives associated with boredom. So we got people really bored, as bored as we possibly could. The thing that I found that could get them the most bored, I mean, I couldn't think of a more boring task, apart from listening to me lecture on boredom perhaps, was to get them to copy out phone numbers from a telephone directory. Because not only is it mind-numbingly boring, it's also pretty meaningless. You know, there's just no meaning behind it. So we got them to do that, got them really bored, and then said to them, how many things can you think of, how many uses for two paper cups, you know, the sort you get at a water cooler or plastic cups, can you think of? And we found that those people who were bored thought of more creative things than those people who weren't bored.
Ah, so if you were bored, you were more creative. You could think of more creative things.
Yeah, and what I found so fascinating about this, Ira, is that they have actually isolated the network in our brain when our bodies are not engaged. We look as though we're idle, where our brain goes, where it is not idle. And they call it the default mode network. That name was coined in 2001 by a researcher named Marcus Reichel. And they can see where our brain goes when we get bored and when we trip into this sort of thinking phase, coming up with good ideas.
And, you know, that's actually borne out by a clip we have from our smartphone-toting New Yorkers, Shalom and April, who chimed in on the connection between smartphones and creativity and how maybe old poets were more creative because they had time to be bored.
The cell phone helps to spur the imagination, move it forward. That's an addiction that actually makes sense for your life.
I always think about Keats, like 1800s, and if he had a cell phone, he wouldn't write these 90-line odes. But I'm an anomaly. I'm a poet, so, you know, I'm fiercely loyal to, like, these romantic notions of, you know.
Yeah, yeah. If you're on the phone all day or picking it up, you're not writing these big poems, right? What would Shakespeare be writing? Wait a minute, I've got to write another line here.
Yeah. Or I got another level of Candy Crush to get to. I mean, yeah, that's what I'm wondering, you know? And we haven't proven anything yet, but we do have some interesting data, and Alex has some of the preliminary numbers that we've gotten.
Right. So a lot of the people that have signed up have told us why, and actually, you know, a disproportionate number say something like, I was hoping to write a book or a novel or a play. A couple of academics who say they're working on a big project. But it seems like we ask people, you know, when do you have time to think? And when do you have time to focus on that big project in your life? And most of them, well, you want to guess? I mean, they said they don't have it. We have, let's see.
I would guess like a great majority who are using the phone all the time.
Yeah, so about 89% said, I don't have enough time to sit and think anymore. And we put it in the context of thinking about big ideas or big projects. So obviously, this is a selection bias kind of sample. These are the 1,000 people in the subset of our big project. But you get the idea that there's just this big pent-up demand to just think.
Well, that makes sense. You know, there's this movement to mindfulness now. You know, mindfulness, where you sit quietly and you think about what you're just doing at the moment. Maybe that's why the mindfulness movement is getting some legs again, because people want to find a way out of that the lock they have or the lock their phone has on them.
Well, I wonder also, though, if there's a key difference here, because with mindfulness, it's about being in the moment. It's about being present. And from what I've learned about where in the default mode when we go into daydreaming, it's much more about time traveling. We think about how we can make things better in the future. We set goals. We figure out steps to get to those goals. We also do something called positive constructive daydreaming. That's the good kind of daydreaming. Sure, there are some downsides to being bored. Maybe you ruminate on something or you beat yourself up about something. But if you can get to that positive place, that is when you make the big decisions or when you say, you know, that person I ran into yesterday, wow, that was an amazing interaction. I want that person to be in my life. You make decisions like that. You don't just leave things up to chance or up to your phone.
This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International, talking about you should be bored with with Manuza Marodi and Alex Goldmark. Let's go to the phones. Our number 844-724-8255. Jacob in Homestead Falls, Ohio. Hi, welcome.
Hi.
Hey there. Go ahead.
So I believe that boredom is something that is a necessity in someone's life. How you were talking earlier about how, you know, you go through these moments where you're bored of, like, you're feeling down and stuff. But I feel like today with phones, if somebody wants to say something mean, when you were growing up as a kid before, you'd say something mean to someone to their face and you'd see this feeling wash over them of just pain because you realize you hurt somebody. And that didn't feel good. But now people have become, they can type something in their phone and set it off, and they think, ooh, that felt great. And they don't understand this in effects. Without this, like, interaction, it's not helping us. And then with the boredom, I think, like, just letting those feelings wash over you of, like, you know, letting them go through you, your feelings of misery or destruction, however, I think it makes a person better. It allows them to have deeper thoughts.
All right. Good point. Let me get some reaction to that.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. I love what your caller just said about going to a dark place before you get to the good stuff. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, that is absolutely key to this. I just remember as a kid, you know, I'm bored. I'm so bored. And I had to get through the misery before I went away and created a palace out of toilet roll papers or something crazy that I don't think a lot of kids get an opportunity to do anymore because their parents are pushing gadgets in front of them because we've kind of lost the muscle to go through the sort of uncomfortableness of being bored because we're not used to it. We're just not used to it.
I want to go back to a point we were talking about before about the paper out last year that showed that two-thirds of men would rather self-administer an electric shock than sit in a room bored for 15 minutes. So boredom is boring. We don't like it, but that may be precisely why it's good for us. And we talked about that with Heather Lynch, a research psychologist at Texas A&M, and here's what she had to say.
The experience of boredom and that aversive quality of boredom might help motivate people to pursue new goals. So the idea is that boredom signals to us that whatever we're doing right now is no longer satisfying. And it's aversive, and so it also motivates us to seek out new, more satisfying activities.
Mm-hmm.
That's interesting to me because, Alex, I remember we heard from a couple people who said that they quit their day job in order to pursue, you know, the big book or the big creative endeavor and that they haven't been able to do it because they're just on their phone all the time.
Right. So, I mean, we asked, what do you want to change about your phone usage? And 0% of people said, I talk too much on my phone, right? The thing that they said that they do too much on their phone is checking and opening it. That was the number one answer. It's not even doing anything. It's just this compulsion. What's there? What's there? What's there?
Right.
That's what people want to cut down on. And then just in the aggregate, social media also was the, you know, pretty big answer there. But it's this idea that you just have to know what's going on at all times instead of just being okay seeing what your head and your imagination comes up with.
Is it still time to sign up for Bored and Brilliant?
Oh, yeah.
Sure
we
is.
Want you to join us. We are 11,000 strong. We want to be stronger because of you. Come join us. NewTechCity.org/bored. When you sign up, you will trigger a welcome newsletter with all the instructions. We are having so much fun already and, like, trying to make some of our own pseudoscience as well. And, like, I just want to be clear. Like, we're a tech show. I love my phone. Don't get me wrong. Like, it's not going away. But what I want to do is I want to think thoughtfully. I want to be thoughtful about when and how I use it and make sure that it fits into the parts of my day where I need it. And when I don't, I want to know that I can take care of myself.
You want to be in control.
Exactly.
Yes.
Tell my phone who's in control. I am in control, phone, not you.
We control the vertical. We control the horizontal. Different show from the 60s. The Outer Limits. Thank you. Thank you both for taking down the viewers today.
That was fun.
Manu Samarodi and is host and managing editor of WNYC's New Tech City podcast, and Alex Goldmark is senior producer of New Tech City. BJ Liederman composed our theme music. Our thanks to our production partners at the studios of the City University of New York. If you missed any part of the program, you'd like to hear it again, please subscribe to our podcast. We have audio and video. Point your tablet or your smartphone to our website, speaking of your phone, and you want something good to do with it, point it to sciencefriday.com, where you can also join our mailing list. And you can also, you know, download our apps, Android and iPhone, and listen and take it along with you when you have time later. If you'd like to write us, please send your letters to Science Friday, 19 West 44th Street, room 412, New York, New York, 10036. Email scifry@sciencefriday.com. Have a great weekend. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.